Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Pyongyang wants U.S. apology for Sony accusations. And Tunisia elects El Sebsi as president. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. North Korea has called on the United States to apologize for implicating Pyongyang in the hacking of Sony Pictures and threatened to fight back in a variety of ways, including cyber warfare. The National Defense Commission for Pyongyang said in state media late Sunday that the U.S. government was wrong to blame North Korea for the hacking. It also said the claims are groundless. Meanwhile, China's foreign ministry says it does not have enough information to determine whether reports that North Korea used Chinese facilities to stage a cyber attack on Sony Pictures are true. The United States is in talks with China to possibly help block cyber attacks from Pyongyang. Tunisians are awaiting the official results of the country's presidential election, which is seen as a landmark in the country's move to democracy. Preliminary results have not been released, but candidate Baji Kaid Essebsi, anti-Islamist party, quickly claimed victory over his rival, interim president Moncef Marzouki. Mr. Essebsi's campaign manager said initial indication showed a victory for the 88-year-old former minister. Mr. Marzouki's campaign manager dismissed the claims. Tunisia was the first to depose its leader in the Arab Spring, and it inspired other uprisings in the region. This is VOA News. The gunman who shot dead two New York City police officers had a history of violence and mental illness, according to a top police official. 28-year-old Ishmael Brinsley shot and killed officers Wenjin Liu and Rafael Ramos as they sat in their patrol car Saturday in Brooklyn. He then fled into a nearby subway station where he shot and killed himself. Prior to the shooting, Brinsley posted anti-police and anti-government messages on Instagram and alluded to taking revenge for the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, both unarmed black men who died at the hands of white police officers. Brinsley was black. The officers he killed were Asian and Hispanic. Police say Brinsley had a history of mental illness and had attempted suicide several times, including last year when he tried to hang himself. An explosion at a bus station in Nigeria has killed at least 20 people. Local officials say the bomb wounded another 21 people at the bus station in Gombe City. No one has claimed responsibility, but the attack Monday took place in northeastern Nigeria, where the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram has repeatedly staged attacks on civilians in its efforts to carve out an Islamic state. Pakistan's Interior Minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali Khan says the government has information that terrorists may be planning another attack, like last week's bloodbath at a military school. He said, after this incident and after the hangings that have been carried out and also because of the military operations that our armed forces are carrying out in that region, we are receiving intelligence from across the country that the militants are getting ready for another savage and inhumane counterattack. Khan's warning came as hundreds of Pakistanis joined rallies across the country Sunday to protest against the Peshawar school massacre, in which 148 people were killed, most of them children. South Korea says the computers of its nuclear power plant operator have been hacked. Government and Korea hydro and nuclear power officials say the cyber attack has not had any impact on the safety of the country's 23 nuclear reactors. An Australian court has revoked the bail of the partner of a deranged Iranian-born man who last week carried out deadly attacks in a cafe in Sydney. Amira Drudis was the partner of Manharan Monis, who was shot dead last week when a swarm of heavily armed police stormed the cafe where he held 17 hostages for more than 16 hours. Drudis had been free on bail after she was charged with the murder of Monis' ex-wife. That's the news from the Voice of America.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A Roman Catholic archbishop in the Central African Republic grappled with a knife-wielding militiaman who was threatening to kill a Muslim child, according to eyewitnesses of the incident Sunday. Outnumbered and unarmed, the Archbishop of Bangui and his medical team held off what was described as a bloodthirsty mob until the sick girl and her parents could be driven to safety.
That's Nick Long reporting from Bangui. Details coming up. Also in the news, a bomb blast in northern Nigeria this morning has killed about 20 civilians. And exit polls claim secular candidate Beji Said Essebsi has won Tunisia's first free presidential election. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga filling in for Sunny, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: Red Cross officials report that a bomb blast at a bus station in Gombe in northern Nigeria this morning has killed about 20 civilians. The explosion occurred before noon at a motor park. Others who were injured have been taken to a local hospital. State police confirmed the report of the bombing. Most bombings and attacks are blamed on factions of Sunni jihadists of the Boko Haram sect. They now control large portions of three states in northern Nigeria, where they have declared a caliphate. One of their leaders, Abubakar Shekau, released a new video showing the mass killings of large numbers of adult men lying face down on what appears to be the floor of a school dormitory. On Sunday, Cameroon's army announced it has broken up a Boko Haram training camp in the Mayo Danai district in the country's far north region. The army was looking for other hideouts in the area, according to Jean-Pierre Imbada, a soldier with the Rapid Intervention Battalion tasked with fighting the insurgents. The Africa director of the International Crisis Group said Boko Haram has increased its regional strength, while military forces of Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and other neighbors have been slow to unite in response. A Roman Catholic archbishop in the Central African Republic grappled with a knife-wielding militiaman who was threatening to kill a Muslim child, according to eyewitnesses of the incident yesterday. Outnumbered and unarmed, the Archbishop of Bangui and his medical team held off what was described as a bloodthirsty mob until the sick girl and her parents could be driven to safety. Nick Long has more on the story from Bangui.
Archbishop Diodone Nzapalainga had spent 4 days with his medical team giving free care to hundreds of people in villages around the town of Yaloke, about 225 kilometres from Bangui. One of the settlements was predominantly Pearl, a Muslim ethnic group that has sided with the Seleka rebels in the past 2 years of conflict. The Pearl community has been a frequent target of the mostly Christian anti-Balaka militia. While in the village, the Archbishop and his team decided to take a sick 8-year-old girl with her parents to Bangui to be treated at the hospital. Although the team had the protection of UN peacekeepers in the villages, their travel to and from Bangui was without any kind of military escort. Returning to Bangui, the Archbishop and his team were stopped by the anti-Balaka at a roadblock 26 kilometres north of Bangui. A doctor with the team, Elkanah Ndawacha, tells VOA what happened next.
C'était horrible l'acte que nous avons vu de la part de nos frères les anti-Balaka. Ils avaient une grenade en main.
He says it was horrible. The anti-Balaka had a grenade and they threatened to throw it at our cars if the group tried to leave. They also had knives, he says, and they dragged a Pearl out of one of the cars and were going to kill him. And Ndawacha says Archbishop Nzapalainga intervened and grabbed the arm of the man who was about to draw a knife. The man pulled out the knife and the Archbishop was left holding the sheath. The doctor tells VOA that the 8 people with the Archbishop had to argue and fight with the 10 anti-Balaka for 10 minutes before they could get away.
Et nous sommes battus avec les anti-Balaka pour les empêcher de ne pas tuer les Pearls que nous avons dans la voiture.
He says finally they got the Pearl back into the car and fled with them in 2 vehicles, while the Archbishop stayed behind with the other 2 cars and restrained the anti-Balaka. A local journalist who also witnessed the incident, Yovis Uwakara, confirmed the account. The sick girl made it to the Archbishop's house and was transferred to a hospital. Ndowacha says the incident happened next to a roadblock manned by Central African police or gendarmes.
On était à peu près à 10 à 15 mètres de la barrière de la gendarmerie.
He says they were about 15 meters from a gendarmerie roadblock, but none of the gendarmes intervened to help. Many observers have questioned the neutrality of the Central African security forces in the CAR's sectarian conflict. The Catholic Church is one of the few organizations still providing any medical aid in the villages of the CAR, and its teams often face harassment from armed groups. Commenting on the Sunday incident, missionary Father Patrick Mbeya, head of the Congregation of the Holy Spirit in the CAR, says this conflict is not one of religion because the actions of the anti-Balaka can in no way be described as Christian. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Tunisia's first free presidential election may be over as exit polls claim secular candidate Beji Said Esbesi has won, but opposition candidate Monsef Marzouki refuses to concede the Sunday vote. In the nation where the Arab Spring began, the first major step to peaceful and democratic governance appears within reach. Hours after the polls closed, there are no major charges of voting irregularities after a hard-fought campaign. Esbesi claimed victory when exit polls gave him more than 55% of the vote. He is the 88-year-old founder of the Nida Tunes Party. He served as parliamentary speaker under longtime president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and interim prime minister when Ben Ali was ousted in 2001. Marzouki is a 67-year-old human rights activist who was forced into exile during the Ben Ali regime. He served as president of the interim government. He assured voters he would respect the outcome of the election. Results are expected to be announced later today. The Sunday vote was a runoff of earlier vote in which Esbesi won 39% and Marzouki won 33%. This is the first free election of a president since the country achieved independence from France in 1956. Sunday Bayak is a 16-year-old boy in South Sudan. When fighting started in Bentiu, where he lived with his brother, he fled like thousands of others to UN-protected sites. Many of his male friends and peers joined the rebels, either to take revenge for the killings of their relatives or out of hunger or both. Trauma, fear, and anger are big inside the UN displaced persons camp. But Sunday, who doesn't know if the rest of his family is still alive, is trying to prevent his generation from following in the footsteps of their fathers. Benno Mochler has more on the story from the camp.
About 50,000 people live on the protected UN site near Bentiu in the north of South Sudan. Half of them are children and teenagers. Sunday Bayak is one of them. This morning he helps organize younger children so that they have something to do. Both government and opposition fighters have used child soldiers. Many of Sunday's friends took up arms.
My work with young children is there to teach them. If they don't know something, I'm going to teach them. If they're going was a bad way, I'm telling that this way is not good for you and let us go to good way and let be in peace. We don't need people to die. We need to be in peace.
Sunday helps organize sports games and discussions and teaches peace songs, a way to roll back war propaganda that the government broadcasts via FM radio into the UN camp. Lately, youth gangs have emerged in the camps and formed along the lines of the opposing parties. Michael Dengaduel is a teacher and works at a makeshift school that was just opened by the UN and humanitarian organizations.
We encourage them to come to school and forget what has been happened to them. Because some of the children, they lost their family. And also some of the children, they are vulnerable. They are not able. They are traumatized.
A political dispute spiraled into ethnic conflict in a country just 3 years old, leaving hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese displaced. It seems a human tragedy that the youngest generation is now going through the exact same things their parents and grandparents experienced in South Sudan's decades-long war for independence. Deng says the only solution to South Sudan's conflict is for people to sit down and reconcile. Perhaps Sunday Bayak and those young people he influences will be able to show the way. Benno Müchler, VOA News, Bentiu, South Sudan.
The World Health Organization reports that the number of people who have died in West Africa's Ebola virus disease outbreak is now more than 7,000. The rate of infection has slowed in Liberia and Guinea, but continues to rise in Sierra Leone, where approximately 400 new deaths were recorded in the past week. In Sierra Leone, a medical doctor is broadcasting on national radio a chilling message discouraging traditional burial practices. Dr. Desmond Williams says he has one wish. If I die, I want the deaths to stop with me. On the air, Williams tells his family to request a safe burial by health workers in yellow personal protective suits if he does die of Ebola. Ebola has killed more than 2,000 people in Sierra Leone, and unsafe burials may be responsible for up to 70% of new infections. In response, officials leading the fight to stop Ebola in this country have threatened to put in jail anyone who washes the body of a family member who dies of Ebola. Other prominent Sierra Leoneans, pop stars and radio DJs, are joining Williams on radio to ask others to take the pledge to wait and let trained health workers bury those who die of Ebola. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met over the weekend with President Alpha Conde of Guinea, where the first evidence of the fatal virus was discovered in March. The UN official expressed concern with the growth of recent infections and deaths on a heavily forested region. The forests straddle the three states struggling to contain the disease for more than 9 months. And Amnesty International is hailing countries like Zimbabwe, blamed for serious rights abuses, and others for signing and ratifying the International Arms Treaty at the UN. The treaty, which seeks to help curb the illicit trades in arms, comes into effect next week. Sandra Muchara interviewed Amnesty International's Marka Marchansky, head of military security and police at Amnesty International.
The treaty is important because if it's ratified and implemented, it will stop weapons and arms and ammunition which contribute and facilitate violations of human rights, crimes against humanity, genocide and war crimes from happening. We all know how this kind of transfers of weapons, illicit trade in weapons, facilitate this kind of activities by states which don't abide by international law, but also armed groups. If you want to have an example of why it is so important, if you think about the amounts of weapons that were sent to Afghanistan at the end of the 80s, in the 80s and in the 90s, and you know how it ended up with being used by groups like Taliban and so on. If you think about the amount of weapons that are being sent almost every day for the last 30 years or even more than that, to the Middle East and North Africa region, I'm talking especially about Syria, Iraq now, you know how important it is to stop this floodgate of weapons from being distributed to governments which are not able to use it in a responsible way, how they are not able to use it, how it is not possible to stop it at this stage before the treaty enters into force from being used by armed groups which don't abide by international humanitarian law or human rights standards. So this is, I think, the first chance for the international community to make this important move and to ratify the treaty globally. So we're hoping that from now on the situation will be much, much different in the way that states which ratify the treaty would need to conduct an assessment of whether the arms that they send and sell, whether they contribute to those violations. So this kind of assessment, they need to be very objective. They need to take into consideration all those kind of human rights factors that should be taken into place to make sure that those arms are not used to commit human rights violations around the world. But for this to happen, we need to have a system, a global system of states which actually support the treaty, meaning it's not enough to have, let's say, 60 states as we have at this stage. We need to have all UN member states ratifying or acceding to the treaty so that we can talk about a global system to prevent illicit trade in arms.
And Marek, for a country like Zimbabwe, what does it mean, to sign the treaty and to ratify? Because I noticed that some countries have signed and some have ratified. What is the difference?
Well, if a country signs a treaty, then basically what it says to the international community is that they say that they want to be bound by the objective and the purpose of the treaty. So they are not allowed to ask. They are not allowed to act in a way which defeats the purpose and the objective of the treaty. So if the objective of the treaty, as it is the case with this particular treaty, is to prevent illicit trade in arms, it is to make sure that there is the highest possible standard of protection against this kind of activities, then the states which ratify this treaty need to make sure that they don't do things which basically contradict this objective and this purpose. If a country ratifies a treaty, then it's fully legally bound by the treaty. So there is no way they can say, okay, we didn't know, or there is no way for them to say it's not applicable for us. If they act in a way which is contrary to the treaty, they would be violating international law, which kicks in with the ratification or accession.
That was Marek Marcinski of Amnesty International speaking to reporter Sandra Muchara. Kenya is the first African country to embark on an ambitious program to completely eliminate rabies by vaccinating the country's dogs. Other African countries are watching closely to see whether a disease that kills thousands every year could actually be wiped off the continent altogether. Hilary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
To many people, rabies is the stuff of nightmares. But Jean Gilchrist knows it intimately. She's been bitten by rabid dogs 4 times, she says, and knows exactly what to look for.
There's the furious type. I mean, the dog's running rampant and biting everybody and everything, which is very dangerous. And then there's the dumb rabies, where the dog is basically very quiet. They start getting slowly paralyzed.
Gilchrist runs the Kenya Society for the Protection and Care of Animals, or KSPCA, in Nairobi, which shelters more than 100 homeless dogs and regularly sees cases of rabies. But that may not be the situation for long. A new initiative by the Kenyan government aims to completely eliminate rabies by 2030 by vaccinating 70% of Kenyan dogs every year for 3 years in a row. Austin Bitek of the Zootonic Disease Unit, who heads the project, says rabies is finally getting the attention it deserves.
This is a disease which has been neglected for a long time. And currently we estimate between 1,000 to 2,000 human deaths occur annually in Kenya. For that reason, it has been ranked as one of the priority zoonotic diseases which have been earmarked for prevention and control.
Rabies is difficult to treat in humans, as early symptoms are similar to flu. By the time telltale rabies effects appear some days later, such as confusion, hallucinations, and agitation, it's too late to treat, and the disease is almost always fatal. If the initiative works, Kenya will be the first African country to eradicate rabies. Bitek says neighboring countries are watching and may replicate the strategy if it succeeds. As in most of Africa, rabies control in Kenya used to focus on simply culling dogs. Often, says Gilchrist, this involved killing every dog found on the street.
They poison them with strychnine, which is not nice. That's the veterinary department. Though they're trying to get away from that now. They've realised that this is not a good thing, and it doesn't do any good, and in the long run does not reduce the population.
As well as being cruel, Bitek agrees that dog culls are ineffective in controlling rabies. Mass vaccination, on the other hand, has been successfully trialled in parts of South Africa, Tanzania, and the Philippines. He says it's been shown to bring rabies levels down to essentially zero. There are millions of dogs in Kenya, and reaching 70% will be difficult, especially in rural areas where dogs tend to run wild. Once enough funding is secured, he plans to send vaccination teams out to 5 pilot counties, eventually reaching every town, village, and farm in the country. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
And the news from the Middle East, a new study finds warring factions in Syria's long-running civil war have damaged or destroyed hundreds of Syrian cultural heritage sites. The study by UNITAR, the UN Institute for Training and Research, uses detailed satellite imagery which tracks and analyzes the extent of the loss. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the UNITAR report in Geneva.
More than 3 years of civil war in Syria has killed an estimated 200,000 people and displaced more than 9 million both within and outside the country. A new UN study finds this heavy human toll is being compounded by the extensive and grievous loss of much of Syria's cultural heritage. Einar Bjorgo is manager of UNITAR's Operational Satellite Applications Program called UNISAT. He tells VOA satellite images show widespread damage to mosques, old ruins, and other cultural sites, including UNESCO World Heritage Sites. He says battle-ravaged Aleppo, where settlements have been in place for more than 7,000 years, has been exposed to major damage. So have sites in other areas, including Damascus, Raqqa, and Palmyra. He says UN experts have looked at 18 different cultural heritage areas and analyzed 200 locations inside these sites to see how they've been affected during the last 3 years of war.
24 are completely destroyed, 104 are severely damaged, 85 are moderately damaged, and we also observe possible damage to 77 of these locations. So it is quite large, quite dramatic. And again, it's happening all over the countries. That said, most of these cultural heritage areas are located in the western part of the country.
UNITAR has been analyzing satellite imagery to support the international humanitarian effort in Syria since the start of the conflict in March 2011. While helping the civilian operations, Bjorgo says the startling damage being done to cultural heritage sites also became clear. He says this prompted the agency to undertake a comprehensive study of these historic structures. He says the findings are alarming.
Clearly, most of the damage is deliberate for one reason or the other. So, for example, you know, blowing up with explosives, very old and culturally important buildings. Also, sites being bombarded from aerial bombardment. In addition, we also see, and that's clearly very intentional, looting. We see holes being dug in the ground inside specific heritage sites.
Looted artifacts from Syria reportedly are being sold for tens of millions of dollars on the international market. Bjorgo says the satellite images do not pinpoint who is responsible for the looting or the destruction.
However, yes, there are several cases where there's very strong indications of, for example, aerial bombardments. With the information we have, it can potentially be caused by government forces in the places where we do observe likely aerial bombardment. There are other cases where we see buildings being blown up in areas controlled by rebel groups. So it is really a mix.
The study provides compelling and alarming testimony of the ongoing destruction of Syria's vast cultural heritage. The United Nations warns this irreplaceable heritage is being obliterated. It urges national and international action to protect and to save these precious treasures from being lost for all humankind. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many times when a man becomes sick with Ebola, it is the woman who cares for him. And then what happens? Then the woman becomes sick. And then who cares for the woman? The grandmother or a family member. Then the children can become infected, as well as others having direct contact with the sick person. This is how Ebola can pass from one person to another in the community. And remember, With the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Exit polls claim secular candidate Beji Said Essebsi has won Tunisia's first free presidential election. The number of people who have died in West Africa's Ebola virus disease outbreak is now more than 7,000. And a bomb blast in northern Nigeria has killed about 20 civilians. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone, and in our feature segment, improving eye health for people in developing countries. I'm Yehi Suhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehi, yes.
So what do you have for us on the sports menu for this evening?
Well, yes, we'll kick off with African football.
Thank you.
Thank you. In the African Champs League draw, African champions Algeria's Entente Satif will begin the defense of their title against Barak Young Controllers of Liberia or the Gambia's Real du Banjul. The Algerians, along with six other clubs, were given byes into the first round of the 2015 African Champions League. Cotton Sport of Cameroon, Congo's AC Leopards, Egypt's Al Ahly, TP Mazembe of Diara Congo, and Tunisia's duo of CSS and Esperance are the other clubs who are into the first round. Three former winners are in the preliminary round. Ghana's Asante Kotoko face East End Land of Sierra Leone. Nigeria's Enyimba will play Bafos from Benin, while Raja Casablanca takes on Diablo Noir of Congo. The tournament gets underway with preliminary round fixtures on the weekend of February 13th to 15th, with second leg games scheduled for a fortnight later. Meanwhile, in Egypt, fans will be allowed to attend Premier League matches for the first time in almost 3 years. Supporters have been banned from domestic games since the Port Said tragedy on February 1st, 2012, when rioting claimed the lives of more than 70 fans. According to the Egyptian Football Association, 10,000 supporters will be allowed at games held in Cairo and Alexandria stadiums and 5,000 fans in smaller venues across the country. However, the ban will remain in place for matches involving any two of the six main clubs, Al Ahly, Zamalek, Al Ittihad, Ismailia, Al Masri, and Damhuru will continue to play in empty stadiums when any of the sides play each other. Since the riot, which occurred at a match between Al Masri and Al Ahly, fans have only been allowed to attend national games and certain matches involving Egyptian teams in continental competitions. Now, for more sports news, let's join Nightline Africa's Shegun on the dot at AMA in Lagos, Nigeria. Hello, Shegun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Spanish club Real Madrid defeated San Lorenzo of Argentina 2-0 on Saturday to win the 2014 Club World Cup and secure its fourth trophy of 2014. The Spanish Giants dominated the final, with Sergio Ramos and Gareth Bale getting on the score sheet. Real added the year-ending trophy to the Champions League, Copa del Rey, and the European Super Cup titles it had already secured in 2014. It will also end the year on top of La Liga, the Spanish top division league. Earlier, New Zealand's Auckland City claimed third place after defeating Mexican club Cruz Azul 4-2 in a penalty shootout to become the first Oceania team to win a medal at the tournament. The two sides were locked 1-1 at the end of normal time. In the shootout, Sani Issa scored the eventual winner for the semi-professionals from Auckland. The Kiwis had made the third-place playoff by beating Moroccan side Maghreb Tetouan 1-0 and then seeing off African champion ES Setif of Algeria by the same scoreline. They narrowly missed out on a place in the final when they conceded an extra-time goal in a 2-1 loss to San Lorenzo. For the victory, Real Madrid got $5 million, while the runner-up received $4 million. The FIFA Club World Cup is contested annually by continental champions, plus the host nation's national champion. Morocco hosted the tournament for the second year running. Turning to African football, the King of Morocco suspended the country's sports minister for his duties for the Club World Cup on Friday and ordered an investigation into the state of the soccer field at Moulay Abdellah Stadium in Rabat after heavy rain disrupted the match. Last Saturday, players from Mexican club Cruz Azul and Australian team Western Sydney Wanderers were slipping and sliding through pools of water on the field after a downpour. The International Players Union asked FIFA for an investigation, describing the conditions as dangerous. Subsequent matches were moved to Marrakech. The state of the field has been seen as a national embarrassment after the entire complex had recently been upgraded at a cost of $25 million. The order by King Mohammed VI, which was issued in the palace statement carried by the state news agency, came after a week of uproar. Sports Minister Mohamed Ouzin had faulted Spanish company Voltec for its work on the field. The company responded that it was a drainage issue, and it had earlier warned the field was not ready. In more football news, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, plans to give a further $300,000 bonus to each of its 209 member federations from the 2014 World Cup revenues. FIFA says the payments will help cover the cost of qualification for the 2018 FIFA World Cup. The payments follow FIFA President Sepp Blatter's promise in June that each member will get a $750,000 bonus. FIFA banked more than $4 billion from commercial deals linked to the tournament. In other news, FIFA says the 2018 World Cup final in Russia will be played on Sunday, July 15th. Confirming the tournament dates on Friday, the FIFA Executive Committee agreed that the opening match will be played on Thursday, June 14th. The 2018 World Cup officially kicks off next March with the first of more than 800 qualifying matches. The main qualifying matches and groups will be drawn on July 25th in St. Petersburg, Russia. Finally, FIFA is abolishing age limits for international referees. FIFA says it is relaxing the rule which forced match officials to leave its international lists at the end of the year they turned 45. Now referees shall be carefully evaluated annually after reaching that age. FIFA said on Friday that officials will undergo technical assessments, medical examinations, and fitness tests by its referees committee. The FIFA Executive Committee decision comes after President Sepp Blatter was affected by an International Olympic Committee, IOC, ruling on age limits last week. The Olympic movement upheld the ruling forcing IOC members to step down in the year they reach 80. Blatter, a member since 1999, will leave in 2016. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Mpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Nightline Africa's Segun on the Dota DMA reporting from Lagos. Now on to Johannesburg, South Africa, where Daybreak Africa's Mark Homa is standing by with more sports news. Mark starts with a basketball.
Angola's Libolo are the new Africa Men's Club Basketball Champions. Libolo beat Tunisia's ES Rades 86-68 in the finals played in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Saturday. Tunisia's Club Africains snatched the bronze medal after they edged Egypt's Sporting Alexandria 79-74 in the third-place playoff. Tunisia's US Monastir placed fifth following their 86-78 triumph over outgoing Angolan champions Primero de Agosto, while the Democratic Republic of Congo's Mazembe outplayed Mayotte Island's Mtsapere 82-67 to claim the seventh place. In Egypt, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria Golden Eaglets are set to play host Niger in their opening match at the Orange Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey on the 15th of February. According to the draws held in Cairo on Sunday, Guinea and Zambia are also in Group A. Defending champions Ivory Coast take on South Africa in their Group B opener before later playing Cameroon and Mali in their other preliminaries. Staying in Cairo, host Senegal encounter Nigeria in the opening match at the Orange Africa Under-20 Championships in Dakar on the 8th of March. Following the draws for the tournament, the Republic of Congo and Ivory Coast are also in Group A, while Group B features Ghana, Mali, South Africa and Zambia. Finally, in boxing, Algerian Jamel Dahou knocked out Mexican Daniel Valenzuela in the first round to retain his UBO World Welterweight title in Bordjibou, a town some 150 kilometers east of the Algerian capital Algiers, on Saturday.
Thanks, Mark. That was Mark Omar reporting Johannesburg, South Africa. In athletics, Timoth Kirotich scored his third victory on Spanish soil at the 35th edition of the Cross Internationale de Venta de Bones on Sunday. The inform Ugandan won by a commanding 24 seconds in 3 weeks ago, but on this occasion, Toroitich didn't feature at the front of the seniors' main race until the 7th kilometer. Toroitich, a pre-race favorite, was emboldened when top-ranked steeplechaser Jairus Bayrek pulled out at the last minute, although his winning margin in the 10.575-kilometer race was comparatively modest at 4 seconds. Toroitich will see return to Spain next month for the IAAF cross-country permit race in Seville on 18th January before finalizing his preparations for the IAAF World Cross-Country Championships in Guangyan, where he will be looking to improve on his fifth-place finish from 2013. In the women's 6.775-kilometer race, Mimi Belete easily defeated European 1,500-meter champion Saifan Hassan from the Netherlands. And that's it for this edition of the Sunnyside of Sports. I'm Douglas Mpuga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Yahayas.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, improving eye health for people in developing countries. And next, a better diet to better pregnancy outcomes. But first, some music. Here is Rapture's Kids from Sierra Leone with ABC.
All the doctors and the lawyers and the PhDs.
Sierra Leone's Rapture Kids with ABC. Improving eye health for people in developing countries is just one of the goals of the Confederation of National Development NGOs, Light of the World. The NGO has been working in Ethiopia to eradicate trachoma, an illness in parts of the country that is also preventable. Kim Lewis visited a couple of healthcare centers just outside of Mekelle in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, where doctors are treating patients with eye diseases.
Trachoma is an infectious bacterial disease usually caused by poor hygiene and is found in regions of extreme poverty. This preventable and treatable condition is the leading cause of infectious blindness in the world. Left untreated, trachoma leads to trichiasis, an eyelid abnormality in which the eyelashes are misdirected and grow inwards towards the eye, scratching the cornea and causing blindness. At the Gamora Health Center in Gamora Village, patients wait to be seen and treated for eye infections. Health worker Gabrielle Selassie explains the importance of reinforcing a strategy developed by the World Health Organization to help eradicate trachoma. It's called surgery, antibiotics, face washing, and environmental sanitation, or SAFE. Surgery is the last stage of the strategy, with more emphasis placed on preventative measures. Life of the World works with local communities to educate people on this strategy.
Currently, we are doing to implement the SAFE strategy, which is the prevention strategy of trachoma. And here we are conducting two main activities. Number one is distribution of antibiotics for active trachoma. And the second one is operating people for those who have a chronic stage of trachoma. And the surgery is called under the S, which means surgery component. And the antibiotic is categorized under the antibiotic distribution. So trachoma can be prevented through the SAFE strategy. Antibiotic, surgery, and the remaining two components are environmental sanitation and face washing. In this mass treatment, everybody who is living in this cavale will receive the treatment.
The Gamora Health Center currently provides eye care and services for approximately 8,000 people. One of the patients is a 40-year-old woman who is the mother of five children. She may have trichiasis and needs to see a doctor for diagnosis and possible surgery. She explains through English translation why she is waiting to see the doctor.
To treat my eye. I have a discomfort on my eye and I have vision problem. Because I have a severe pain, discomfort, so I will not afraid for the surgery.
Another man describes his feelings after having surgery. The surgery was to restore the eyelashes to their proper position.
I am very happy. At initial, I was afraid, but now I am comfort.
Providing treatment for eye diseases is another focus for Light for the World. At the Kiha Eye Hospital Vision Center in Mekelle, cataract patients wait patiently to see a doctor for treatment or for surgery. The cost of the surgery could go over $1,000, but the cost is covered by patients who can pay something towards the bill and by donors. The eye hospital is open Monday through Friday for regular patient care and 24 hours for emergency treatment. One very young woman sits quietly in the pre-op area waiting for her surgery. She has glaucoma. Ophthalmologist Dr. Tilahun Kuras explains the procedure he is about to perform.
The procedure is called trabeculectomy. Just what I make is I make a flap over the sclera as I make fistula to bypass the normal the meshwork. Then the fluid of the eye flows with that fistula outside to the subconjunctival area, and it's going to be absorbed there.
Dr. Kuros' colleagues say the doctor is known for being good and quick. They say he also displays a gentleness and kindness with his patients. Outside in the waiting area, a young woman shows a very serious eye infection in her left eye. It is swollen and very red, but the doctor says she is still able to see.
Her vision is good, but the problem is with the movement because of the nerve palsy or the nerve is paralyzed.
What causes that?
Most is the cause of nerve palsy here are due to injuries.
Injuries.
But sometimes they may be due to infections, viral infections, hemorrhages, chronic diseases. But in these young ladies, most probably it's due to injury.
The morning spent at the Vision Center is one of many busy days for doctors and health workers, but all are working for one goal: to make sure their patients get the proper eye care they need so they can get on with their lives. I'm Kim Lewis, reporting from the Tigray region of Ethiopia.
A new study links lower levels of vitamin E with higher rates of miscarriage. As we hear from health reporter R. Chimes, the study of women in Bangladesh suggests a better diet may lead to better pregnancy outcomes.
For years, researchers at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore have been working with local teams in rural Bangladesh studying maternal and child health. In this new study, they focused on the levels of vitamin E in blood samples taken early in pregnancy. One of the study leaders, Carrie Schulze, says they found a link between those levels and the risk of losing the baby.
Women who at the beginning of their pregnancies had adequate concentrations of vitamin E in their blood were half as likely to go on and have a miscarriage.
About 10% of the women with low vitamin E lost their baby, compared with the 5% of pregnant women with higher vitamin E levels who miscarried. Vitamin E is found in some cooking oils and nuts, part of a normal, diverse diet. It could be given as a supplement. Pregnant women in Bangladesh already get extra iron and folate, but Schulze says adding vitamin E may not be effective in preventing miscarriages, which can occur very early in pregnancy.
And often, if you're talking about supplementing women during pregnancy, they're not actually getting those supplements until well into their pregnancies, you know, after that window of opportunity for preventing miscarriage would have closed.
Schulze's research is complicated somewhat because her team actually looked at two forms of vitamin E. We've been talking about one, known as alpha-tocopherol, which is the most active form in the body and seems to be associated with successful pregnancies. However, high levels of a less active form, known as gamma-tocopherol, were related to higher risk of miscarriage. But that association was statistically weaker and less important. The study by Johns Hopkins associate scientist Carrie Schulze and colleagues is published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. When activists at the joint mobile group Human Rights Group in Chechnya's capital of Grozny saw a number of men attempting to break into their offices on December 13th, they evacuated the premises. Soon after, the offices were on fire. Later, it was discovered that all equipment had been smashed. On the following day, Chechen police entered a joint mobile group-owned apartment without a warrant, ransacked the premises, and confiscated electronic equipment. They body-searched two lawyers who were on the premises at the time and detained them without charges for several hours. Joint Mobile Group is part of a program developed by the Russian non-governmental organization Committee Against Torture. Its purpose is to investigate human rights abuses under Russian-backed Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov. Some 50 lawyers rotate in short shifts throughout this region of Russia, where too many human rights activists and journalists investigating human rights abuses have disappeared or been killed. Both Committee Against Torture and Joint Mobile Group are headed by human rights activists and member of the Kremlin's Human Rights Council, Igor Kalyapin. This most recent attack against human rights advocates has its beginnings in a December 4th attack by insurgents against law enforcement officials in Grozny. 14 law enforcement officers and all insurgents were killed that day. In response, Ramzan Kadyrov announced that the families of the militants would be exiled and their homes destroyed. After several houses and surrounding villages burned down, Igor Kalyapin appealed to Russia's prosecutor general to investigate whether Kadyrov's orders for collective punishment of the insurgents' families might constitute a criminal offense under Article 286 of the Russian Criminal Code. Since then, Mr. Kalyapin has suffered severe harassment. He was pelted with eggs and verbally abused during a press conference and received numerous threatening phone calls and text messages. The United States is extremely concerned by reports of arson at the Grozny offices of the Joint Mobile Group and the threats directed against human rights defenders, including Igor Kalyapin, said State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. We urge the authorities to investigate this incident and the threats against these individuals and ensure the safety of all human rights defenders in Chechnya and across Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. Right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa, don't miss.